Today's sermon, A Response to Hate, is a change than what I had planned, and I think that maybe I'm not as spiritually mature as I'd like to think I am, because my immediate response is a response to hate in relationship to the tragic event at the Unitarian Universalist Church in the Tennessee Valley. There's one side of me that says, well, love is the response to hate. And then there's another side of me that says, I'm not so sure how we should respond to hate. And so after working with myself and realizing I'm certainly not as spiritually mature as the principles that Gandhi used or Martin Luther King, I've concluded that maybe love is a response to hate, but first there must be a comforting of the victims of the actualization of hate onto people first. And second, I think a response to hate in terms of hate being focused on a particular group of people, not necessarily the group of people that have caused the feeling of hate, but a group of people that have become the focus and the target of hate. Because the causes of hate are not necessarily the targets of hate. They don't necessarily go together. And as we read our principles in various forms in different UU congregations, I say to myself, how could those principles become an object of hate? I don't understand it. How can the drive for compassion and freedom and justice become the target of hate? I'm thinking that a response to hate needs to be strength and courage and a conviction to principles. A response to hate of this type means that we need to have a voice in our community, and that voice needs to be heard, and that we should not diminish or retreat, that we should become stronger, and we need to recognize the historical culture and historical context in which we live. I'm going to address today two responses to this act of hate, and at first I'm going to respond in a confused way. And one of the first things that went through my mind after I heard about the murders and the wounding of others, and that they were a target of this person's hate, I became very confused, because in the same story you hear there's a hate of liberals, but food stamps were running out. And I'm thinking, liberals are feeding this man, but this man hates those who are feeding him. And I'm wondering if some of that's not our fault. In our culture, there's a bashing of liberals and a twisting of the truth about who liberals are and the meaning of liberals. And I'm wondering, have we really responded as a religious liberal community to correct the misconceptions? Have we responded? And then I got to thinking, well, what do liberals want? And so without going to any books or reading, I just jotted down as quickly as I possibly could what I want, and then therefore that's what all liberals want, naturally. So I'll project that out there. What do liberals want? Tolerance, liberty for all, our civil liberties to be intact, health care for all, a living wage for all. I was talking to a fella at Walmart. I'm surprised they haven't banned me from Walmart, but I was talking, and I do, you know, so I go there and talk and proselytize, I suppose. And he was telling me, he said, yeah, we were told that if we all made $12 an hour, Walmart would be poor and go out of business. And he was very sincere about that. And I'm thinking, there's the same twist. And now, of course, the big news is Walmart has told its employees not to vote indirectly, but direct enough there may be a legal case not to vote for Democrats, because they vote for Democrats, it's going to be easier to sign up for unions. And my God, if we sign up for unions, the liberals will once again take over the world. So we have a problem with that. So a living wage for all, I would want that. A good education for all children, and be attentive to that. The absence of propaganda from our government and our media. I think that's fair. I think that's what I would want as a liberal. That's what I would want. A society that provides pathways to potentialize the talents and the gifts of all of its citizens. And then I was talking to my son, and he said, you have to put in there to be left alone. So I think there's some truth to that, to be left alone. And I thought, how could these become objects of hate? How could that happen? I've read several responses on the internet from different people, and you might recognize some of them, but I won't mention any names, that have called this a senseless act. An act that doesn't make any sense. How are we to make meaning of something that doesn't make any sense? And I am suggesting that this was not a senseless act. We can make meaning out of this act. And as a matter of fact, I think we can understand how acts like this occur. I think if I called it a senseless act and let it go at that and say this man was clearly disturbed and really does not understand social policy, and just let that go and call it senseless, it doesn't make sense, and be part of the comforting and grieving process the best I can, that it alleviates me of the responsibility to act on what might have caused and contributed to the act, if I call it senseless. But if I have some way of making meaning, and if I have some way of understanding of what happened, does that call me to responsibility to act to try to make it different? To be proactive. So I can avoid my responsibility and abdicate my responsibility of understanding by saying this is a senseless act. And we cannot possibly understand it. On several occasions in the past several years, we've talked about genocide and a fascist state and the making of a fascist state. And some people have liked that, and some people have said, get off that topic and get on to something else. But I'm going to return to that in a minute. Right now, because in that article that Christopher Bolus wrote on a fascist state requires a fascist state of mind, so you must manipulate a mind to be fascist to the individual self in order to have a fascist nation. And there's a process of moving from a liberal democratic mind to an inner fascist mind to do that. And he lists those seven principles: distortion of the truth, decontextualization, belittling, shaming, characterization, changing of a person's name so you can be mean to them. You know, the first thing in conflict, if you're fighting with somebody you care about and you love, generally you don't call them by their first name. Sometimes you call them by a name which objectifies them, which makes it easier to be mean to them. So you change their name when you're moving from. Sometimes we even call our own selves within our inner dialogue, and if we're really upset, we might say it out loud. We might call our own selves names that are not kind. When we do that, we are practicing the fascist state of mind. And then eventually, an absence of reference to the object, to the person, to the idea. He also says something in there that part of this process is intellectual genocide. Intellectual genocide. And on this man's, at least I visioned it at his coffee table, but in his house, it could have been in his library, books among many books, but the way I want it to be, it would justify my own thinking, I arrange it in my mind to do that. So these are the only three books this man owned, but there were books by Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity, and Mike Savage. You know, liberalism is a mental illness. On the Path to Freedom, or some of Ann Coulter's books, right? And in our culture today, there's a lot of disturbances. Financial foreclosures, our country moving away from democracy, some might say. I mean, we're disturbed, or we need to be disturbed about what's going on in our country. My issue today is not this individual man, but it is the language in our culture that has possibly, with the language in those books, and I'm going to describe it in a minute, it's horrible, helps focus hatred. And we look through time and we see people that have been scapegoated by nations in order for the nation to do what it wants to do. For hundreds of years we can go find groups of people that have been scapegoated for those in power to manipulate the country so it can do what it wants to do when it's not good for the citizens of the country. We don't have to look far in history to find that. And I'm saying today, liberals, liberalisms, liberal thoughts is the essence of what it means to be liberal, and the conceptual process of what it means to be liberal, is that in a process of intellectual genocide? Is that being attacked so much so it's being shrunk and diminished? Intellectual genocide, to the point where you no longer make any reference to it. Well, we're certainly not at that point, because there are many people making reference to liberalism, from Rush Limbaugh's his whole shtick. There's nothing else for him. Okay. So just let me read a few thoughts that these people have thrown out. So in case you don't feel persecuted when you leave here, you'll feel persecuted if that would be helpful in some way. This woman, Ann Coulter, she writes a book called Slander, Liberal Lies About the American Right, New York Times bestseller list. She writes another book, Treason, Liberal Treachery from the Cold War to the War on Terrorism, in which she proclaims Joseph McCarthy's a good guy. Okay. And another book, Treason, which was published and also a New York bestseller. If Democrats had any brains, they'd be Republicans. Ann Coulter, on television, talking to Bill O'Reilly, said, we need to take baseball bats and bash in the heads of liberals. I'm not making that up. And Bill O'Reilly did not say, maybe that's a bit much. They just move on. So these things just get dropped in the culture where millions of people hear. And then interesting, in this particular article, there's a question here. It's an interesting legal question. If somebody acts out on that thought, would they be liable, and would that be a crime, at least in civil court? And now, I don't watch a lot of that kind of television, Fox News, periodically, you know, like to hear what they're up to. But this story, this tragic story, in which there was a hero, this tragic story, hasn't been in the press a lot. There's been an absence of reference. I suppose if it were my book that is aggressive against liberals, and then somebody attacked liberals, I might want to avoid the question, do you think your book contributed to this man's thinking process? I think I would want to avoid that question, at least publicly. Maybe not in private with my friends, but at least publicly. Maybe they're afraid this is a legal issue. I don't know, but it certainly has not got the same play. It certainly has not. I mean, we would hear about this man's history, this man's childhood, where this man was from. We hear about the hero's history, his childhood, where he was from. We hear about the life of the other person that died, but we don't hear any of that about this issue. None of that. Then, not to belabor this point, but Bill O'Reilly, the gap between the rich and poor is because of liberal policies, not because of financial institutions pulling the money up out of the domestic policy. No, but liberal policies. People are less fortunate because of liberal philosophy. One place I got upset, he was doing an interview with some guy, and he asked this question. Do you believe income redistribution? Do you believe in that? Do you believe that the government should come in and take a huge chunk of our assets and give it to people, and he says, less fortunate? Because my response is, that is what's going on. The government is taking a big chunk of our assets and giving it to a particular group of people. But the person he was interviewing didn't come back with that and said, well, we need to help and we need that, and it's a Christian thing to do, which is all true. And Sean Hannity, the same thing. This is how silly it gets. Halloween is a liberal holiday because people go around and beg for candy, and that's what liberals do, go around begging for handouts. And I listen to that, and it boggles my mind, but it does help me understand how somebody receiving the benefits that liberals have fought for, food stamps, feed themselves, but yet hate the hand that feeds them. How people receiving Social Security, pension, health care, can complain about socialism, which those are products of the socialism pre-Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who co-opted those things from the Socialist Party so he could expand the Democratic Party so he could win the election. This is some of the history of those programs, right? And yet hate socialism or democratic socialism, but yet that's what's taking care of them, their parents, so they don't have to take care, however that might work. I don't see them sending their Social Security checks back. I don't see that happening. I don't see people saying I don't want help from Medicare, Medicaid and such. So how is it that people receive help that helps them to a better life, hate the principles that gave them the better life? I mean, that's the question we must face. And I'm rather than blame O'Reilly's, Hannity's, because we're always going to have that group of people that slander and make money off of selling snake oil, however we want to frame that. I'm wondering if the blame, if there is to be blame, some of that does not need to come to us, because we have not exercised our full potential in confronting the lies. Because we haven't fully committed ourselves to our own cause. And Unitarian Universalism, for a moment in time, and we argue sometimes and state differences of opinion within this congregation, and rightfully so, to find some kind of middle ground. When Unitarian Universalism withdrew in the 60s and 70s, saying we should not be out there proselytizing, people will come to us in their spiritual journey, at the same time, Christian fundamentalism was moving out, supporting this movement away from what I consider some form of healthy social democracy, balancing it with capitalism through Ronald Reagan and such. Have we been absent in our educating of ourselves and our communities about our values? Have we been absent in exercising the fullness of our strength as a community and as a people? That's the question that lands with me. What is my responsibility if I see inaccuracies and if I see people misusing the values of liberalism to promote their own cause, which is over and against the cause that helps people? And if I don't speak up, or at least try to speak up, am I lying? And my answer to myself is yes. So I encourage us to exercise our full strength and our voice as loud as we can appropriately can in our community to bring attention to the inaccuracies. And then the second response to this act of hate, to some form of remembrance and some form of shared grief with our sister churches, I would respond like this. United in the spirit of our community, characterized by the values articulated in our principles, We are joined into one community. We are miles separated, but not in spirit. The spirit does not know distance, nor the separation of time. Today, our brothers and sisters are in pain and are grieving as we are. When one suffers, so we all suffer. We live in a hard world, and in this hard world, our emotions are numb. We get sick and tired. We don't really want to respond to everything. But yet, at the same time, today we must move past that numbness, allow ourselves to be vulnerable, to hear of the events and the pain and the suffering that happened in Tennessee. We must move past our own defenses. When you go to the webpage of the Tennessee Valley Unitarian Universalist Church, you'll find these words. Love is the spirit of this church, and service is its law. This is our great covenant, to dwell together in peace, to speak the truth in love, and to help one another. And when you look at the rest of their webpage, you indeed do see that in action. When you look at their webpage, you see some aspects of their vision. Their vision is religious education to all people in all ages. They minister to diverse groups and promote cooperation and understanding. Significant impact on social action. Active ministry to high school kids and to college. High visibility into the wider community. Communication of shared ministry practices that enhances open dialogue and a sense of connectedness within the church and the larger community. Sound familiar? It's us. It's our sister church. It's who we are. They don't have the principles. They have what they believe in, and it seems something similar to the principles. We believe in the freedom of religious expression. All individuals should be encouraged to develop their own personal theologies, or I'll add, or not, or to present openly their religious opinions without fear or censure or reprisal. Believe in a tolerance of religious ideas, the authority of reason and conscience. And you know why we have that authority of reason and consciousness in our... Because for hundreds of years, if you practice reason, you were persecuted by the church. I mean, it's in there for a reason. It's not accidentally in there. We believe in a never-ending search for truth and meaning, unity of experience, no fundamental conflict between faith and knowledge and religion and science. We believe in the worth and the dignity of every human being. We believe in the ethical application of religion. Good works are a natural product of good faith, the evidence of an inner grace that finds completion in the social and community involvement. Sound familiar? It's us. It's who we are. I thought I'd read and share a bit about the lives of Linda Krager and Greg McKendry. And when we say that we are sharing in the grief and the loss of our sister church that we find an identification with, you know, my question is, well, what is it that we are grieving? What is it that we have lost? We have a service of remembrance, or we have a quiet time to try to understand that. I want to know what that is. And so I began searching for what that was, and I'll just share a bit about these two people. I don't know how much you have read, but there's an article about Linda Krager, and they were interviewing her niece, Debbie Campbell, and her niece knew Linda is a young girl, and they would play, and she would talk to her, and she had remembrances of that, very positive, and then for many years had no contact. And Linda Krager, she was a professor of college literature, and they reconnected, and they began a life together, and Linda began to share with the 2-year-old Olive her life, and so now her grandniece and her niece are building a history together. Linda Krager had moved to Tennessee with her husband, Dwayne, with another couple who they had been friends with for years, and another professor at another university had written books together. And this other couple had moved to Tennessee to raise their two grandchildren, and Linda and Dwayne had moved with them to help them raise their two grandchildren. What a beautiful picture. What a beautiful picture of this. And so, not only was Linda lost, not only was she lost to that family, but when that little girl is 14 and 15, this professor of literature, my guess is, would have said, "Have you read Margaret Fuller yet? Do you know about the suffrage movement? Do you know who Gloria Steinem was? Betty Friedan." How could she not have done that? We not only grieve what's lost in the here and now for these people, we also grieve for what will not happen for these people. She loved church, had a beautiful smile. We grieve with those who grieve with Linda, with her niece, with her husband Dwayne, their friends Joe and Mary Bernhardt, with Chloe, the 6-year-old granddaughter, her church friends. We grieve with Olive. We grieve with the college students who would have called their mentor 2 years from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, in their career, as I have done, and say, "This is what's going on in my life. What do you think?" When you have that kind of person in your life. We grieve the absence of that. We grieve that which will not be because of her death. Greg McKendry, his response to hate was to stand in its way and protect those behind him, because it was his standing up and standing in the way of this man with the shotgun that gave other people enough time to respond and wrestle him down. So he could not, I guess he had 76 shells. So he was a hero. In this article, Taylor Bessett, the 16-year-old foster son that was just adopted by Greg and Barbara McKendry, comes running out and says, you make sure, his foster son is saying, "You make sure people know he was a hero. You make sure of that." That was his foster son's response. Greg McKendry, he was the fella in the church. If you needed a new refrigerator, he bought one. If you needed a new water heater, he bought one. His friend told him that his daughter was going to college, and the next day, Greg McKendry went and brought boxes for his daughter to pack without being asked, and search postal rates to find the cheapest rate on how to send her stuff to the college. This is who he was. We grieve with those who lost Greg McKendry. We grieve with Taylor Bessett, his stepson, his foster son. We grieve with his wife Barbara, with the friends at his church, with Brian and his daughter Miriam, who's now going off to college. He was active in a social action committee. We grieve with those people. The legal representative of the foster child said these people were saints because people just don't want to take 16-year-old children anymore. And these people, for some reason, took this 16-year-old child. This is who he was. We grieve for that which will not be because of his absence and their absence. But we know Linda, and we know Greg. They sit next to us every Sunday, just as that church is us. So are they. We know them. And we grieve at their loss.